Luke chapter number 12 is where we are at. Luke in chapter number 12. If you have a paper copy of God's word, you pop it open to the middle, you're going to find like Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Keep trucking to the right. You're going to find Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, or just take out your phone and Google Luke chapter number 12. We want you to see right from the Bible what God has to say to you and to me today as he captured or recorded it for us, and we have confidence in that. So Luke chapter number 12. This morning, we're going to talk about rich in all the wrong ways. Rich in all the wrong ways. Most folks seem to love the idea of a get-rich-quick scheme. If they didn't, we'd quit reading about stories like the ones maybe you saw in the news and I did the last 2 weeks. One was a man in Centerville who defrauded multiple older people in Beaver Creek of life savings as their investment manager. Another, sadly, a very well-known tax professional in our area, the Essex firm, indicted on a ton of fraud charges and $11 million worth of embezzlement. Both people promised the people they were taking money from double-digit returns that were assured. And, my friends, that just wasn't the case. You know the old adage, it's almost undefeated. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, right? If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. But hear me out this morning. I'm looking for investors in a sure-proof property plan I've developed. And as your pastor and friend, I just want to give you guys first opportunity here, okay? I've been made aware recently of the ability to collect titles for properties in our area, and these titles are in the most unlikely places you'd ever imagine. In fact, I bet you are walking right by them, not even realizing they are accessible to you and I, just average investors sitting around all around our city. They're stored in boxes in the most weird places. Regular stores, even thrift stores have them. Now, here's what I'm proposing for you all today, all right, out of the kindness of my heart. I'm going to do all the legwork. I'm going to purchase and collect these property deeds or titles, if you will. I just need you all to pony up the capital, and I can guarantee you returns in all of these properties. You might be sitting there thinking, sounds skeptical and fishy after you kind of opened up about fraud. Can we trust you as a man of the cloth? Well, let me try to ease some of your concerns. There are places you've heard of, places like Indiana Avenue, St. James Avenue, even Park Place Avenue. I can get us even into maybe utility companies and railroad conglomerates. I think you've figured it out, right? And now I think you've discerned, I'm talking about monopoly properties represented by those tiny little paper cards in each box. That's silly. I say that, we all just kind of like, terrible opening illustration. But what if I was serious? What if in the foyer you heard me all jazzed up about this? And you heard me going person to person, just so excited about this potential yield I'm going to get. And I mean, I'm wringing my hands. I mean, the dollar signs are across my eyes. You find out I'm going to Walmart and I'm just loading up my cart with monopoly. I'm going to the thrift store, loading up my cart with all the monopolies I can grab. And I am just thrilled because I've found this cool property hack. It's just going to net me millions and millions. I'm never going to work again. I'm finally going to get to enjoy the life I was always meant to have of ease and leisure. You're likely going to come up to me and ask, number one, Paul, do you take medications? And number two, are you on them right now? Are you making sure you're taking your medications? Why would that be absurd, even concerning, even troubling, if I was that excited about monopoly property titles? It would be troubling because for any of my resources, any of my time to be devoted to pursuing such a failing, valuable product, it would make you question what kind of delusions I'm under, that I am out of sorts in what I think is real as far as value, real as far as valued usage of my time, real as far as what I think I will gain, real as far as what I actually value in this life. Do we all get it? Right. That's a concern. But I want to highlight today from the passage how Jesus looks at you and I chasing after the cares of this world and what we think is valuable versus what he has already told us clearly is valuable. I want you to look at Luke chapter 12. Verse number 13 is where we're going to pick up in our series, Every Day with Jesus. We've been talking in the first part of the chapter about hypocrisy and how we need to fear God rather than man. Live in awe of God. Be submitted to God as his followers. Now he continues in chapter 12, verse 13, with a conversation with somebody shouting out from the crowd, and he teaches an important lesson to them and to you and I today. So verse 13. And one of the company, remember there's a multitude gathered around him. We don't know who it is. Somebody seems to yell out to Jesus. And one of them said unto Jesus, Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me. He's given Jesus a request, but really more a command, an expectation to be fulfilled for him to see him as legitimate. Look at verse 14. Jesus says to the man, Man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? Take heed, he says to the multitude, and beware of covetousness. For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. And Jesus spake a parable unto them, saying, The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, What shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits. He said, Now this is what I do. I pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, Soul, when you start talking in the third person, that's when you're going the wrong way, right? Soul, thus much goods laid up for how many years? Many years. Take thine ease. Eat, drink, be merry. But God said to this man, what's the word, everybody?
Fool.
Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? Jesus gives the conclusion to the audience there all around him. So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is what? Not rich towards God. Today, Jesus is willing to help you and I with a flawed mindset about money, about gain, about possessions, about the usage of our life, in pursuing that which is not valuable in his idea or his economy. In fact, he is confronting us in that perverse and foolish ideology. But catch it, it is far greater in our consequences to ignore Jesus' words today than the silliness I was talking about earlier with those monopoly properties. Here in our passage, Jesus warns his followers against the pursuit of and reliance upon this realm's wealth rather than treasuring what God does. Here's the idea to walk away with today from the passage. Coveting leaves you poor with God forever by longing for riches that won't last. It leaves you poor with God forever while longing for riches that won't last. As we walk into the passage this morning, here's the first point I want you to consider. Jesus warns his followers then, and even us today, about being possessed by possessions. About being possessed by possessions. Verse 13, we see this man approach Jesus who's there in the crowd of people. Like I said, he gives Jesus kind of this ultimatum and expectation, and it's sinfully motivated in his request. He yells out asking for Jesus to tell his brother to share the inheritance with him. Now, there's Old Testament regulations regarding inheritance for property. So he, as a Jewish man, could be asking for Jesus to help his brother follow the Old Testament law about property, about inheritances, and that he would honor the Lord's commands to the Jewish nation under the law at the time when Jesus was alive. Having said that, that's not what's happening here. Was it a valid request? Was the brother wrong? Luke doesn't explicitly say, but we recognize from the passage, Jesus lays his motivation bare for everyone to understand. He's not asking for somebody to honor God, obey the word, him to be enabled by that to honor God and obey the word. He's asking out of greed. He's not asking out of honor to God. He's asking out of greed. So in verse 14, Jesus gives clarity about his role in his economy and their economy. In verse 14, how does Jesus respond? He asks him a question. Who's made me a judge? In other words, Jesus is saying to this man, I'm not some public official authorized to address your questions, your issues, or your accusations. I'm not somebody who can come before a court of justice on your behalf. Jesus is reminding them he's not been granted any position with Rome. He's not been granted any position with the Jewish religious sects of their day to act authoritatively in civil or social matters. Ultimately here, Jesus is demonstrating how the Jewish crowds still misunderstand him. They still don't see him for what he is, the suffering Messiah of Isaiah 52 and 53. They're only wanting the King Messiah promised, and like Isaiah 9 and in Daniel chapter number 7. And so when this man is coming to Jesus asking for this, his motivation is wrong, and his ideology about Jesus is all wrong as well. Dealing with this item due to it being driven by greed, frankly, are beneath the ministry of Jesus as the Messiah. Now, is Jesus not concerned about justice? Oh, he's very concerned about justice. Is he not concerned about the word of God being honored and God ultimately being honored? No, he certainly was. But because of the motivation here, this is well beneath what Jesus came to accomplish and what he desired for the man asking or for all those who were listening then and even for you and I today. Jesus wants this man to understand and you and I to understand today that his economy and his values far exceed simple petty items like earthly inheritances. I like the way one author said it. He said it like this. This may imply that Jesus does not have the legal standing to make such a decision, but it more likely means that he hadn't come to deal with temporary trivia, but to offer the world eternal salvation. In light of the arrival of God's kingdom, issues such as inheritance rights are of little consequence. As we know, it's better to suffer for following Jesus than to get what you think you're owed in this world. So friends, verse 15 is how Jesus continues this dissection. In verse 15, Jesus focuses on the motivations, and again, it's perverse ideology from the individual holding it. And I want you to see in verse 15 how Jesus gets their attention, and it should grab our attention. Have you ever been to like a boxing fight or an MMA fight? What happens at the start of each round? Some kind of alert, right? Some kind of bell, ding, 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 ding. What's that call the two fighters to do? Better pay attention. If that bell goes off and you're just standing there chilling out, you're about to have a real bad day, aren't you? Think about what Jesus says here. He starts off getting their attention by saying, take heed. Literally, it comes with this idea of what? Pay attention. Take notice. I want you to be vigilant. I want you to be on the lookout for something I'm about to discuss with you. I want you to take significant notice. I want you to pause. I want you to reflect inwardly with intentionality for your own betterment, your own safety, your own well-being. It'd kind of be like this idea of if a police officer sadly heard that a shooting had happened with another officer in the city and a bolo was out, be on the lookout, right? How would that officer handle that? Casually? Flippantly? Nonchalantly? Oh no. If it was a silver Tacoma truck, he'd be pulling over every single Tacoma truck, right? He'd be finding that thing. He'd be aware. Jesus is giving that kind of emphasis to the crowd and to you and I, if we claim to be his followers today. Take heed. And then he adds another layer of emphasis here. Take heed and what? Beware. He heightens it. Beware. Watch, guard, protect yourself. The idea is watching or guarding oneself because of looming threats from outside with others, or from your own misguided desires inside you, your own bad thoughts. So take heed and beware of what? Covetousness. Now, that's not really a word we roll around using, right? In the office around the water cooler. How's your weekend? Well, I'm not going to lie. I had some covetousness working in my life. Yeah, probably not using that word too often. It's still in the dictionary. I get it. if we just want to call it what we would use in everyday language now in our time, a dynamic idea would be, you're greedy. Take care and beware of greed, of being insatiable, the desire for more and more and more and more for your satisfaction, for your ideas, for your desires, for your cravings, for your longings. When we talk about being covetous, usually included in that mixture, you've got covetousness, you've got jealousy, you've got envy. And what is that just all stirred into a pot of? I don't have what I want to have. I'm afraid of losing what I do have. I'm not happy you have what you have. I think God should give me what you have. I'm owed it. So it's just this nasty pot of greediness. In this situation, Jesus is calling out the man in verse 13 who was saying, I need what I deserve. Jesus gives a response, but it's not the one the guy thinks he's going to give. I want you to look at verse 15 again. He says what? Take heed, beware of covetousness. And then he gives the why. He reframes it. A man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. Jesus' response here reframes what this man and what you and I should desire, chase after, or trust in what's valuable. Our view is very trapped in time in foolishness. We worry about wealth. We worry about possessions. We worry about prestige. We worry about the positions or the titles we'll have or could get or could hold. We operate upon this thinking that that gives me value as an individual. That forges my identity as an individual. That will bring me comfort as an individual. That will boost my confidence as an individual. But Jesus says, it can't and it won't. Eternal God says that when we think that way, our gauge is off and it's been tweaked by our sin nature. It's been forged by culture, and we are looking to the wrong things or the wrong people for comfort and confidence due to our greediness. And Jesus says what? Beware. I want to make a clear point here. Jesus is not condemning anyone being rich. He's not condemning anyone who has wealth. I get our culture has this vein of automatic esteem for the rich or automatic hatred for anyone wealthy. Jesus isn't calling that out. He is attacking the motive or craving behind it. He's not some financial socialist or ruthless capitalist. He has a greater concerns than those of just those ideas or labels or titles. He concerns himself with the motives of our hearts and what it means for now, but also what it means for forever. And so he warns against being possessed by possessions. My friends, before we go much further, I want to rattle off a few questions for you to think, because here's the reality. We read this passage and we think, bet that guy feels like a dope now, doesn't he? Verse 13, Jesus, give me this. He's going to do what I asked him to. He knows the Old Testament. He's going to do what I asked him to. Then Jesus just kind of fillets him alive audibly for everybody to hear. And we think, that guy. I'm not that guy, thank goodness. Well, if my driving instinct or response would be to worry rather than to pray, if my car breaks down or my boss gives me notice that there's going to be layoffs, or the doctor gives me tragic news and I wonder how I'm going to afford it or pay for it, someone's exiting my life and I worry what that means for my future, my friends, we're likely on the verge, we're already in the midst of coveting. Read. When I view raises, deals, possessions, promotions, inheritances with self-focused thoughts, oh, if I get this, that I can pay off the house sooner. If I get this, we can finally go on that cruise we've been saving for. If I get this, I can finally get my kids to the right college so they can be a success and I can feel better about myself as a parent. If I get this, I'll finally get rid of that drab kitchen and be up to times and up to date. If I get this, I can quit driving my junker of a car and get a new car. Oh, if I get this. Friends, if those are the driving first thoughts, we're not as far away from this guy in verse 13 as we like to think. I'm not trying to be unkind this morning, but I think all of us should be very, very careful living in opulent America that we don't distance ourselves from the guy in verse 13 instead of ask God in a painful way to examine just how much I might be like him and I don't want to admit it. We live, and thank God for it, an opulent, free society. Money flows in the streets in America, friends. It does. But what are we doing with it as Christians? I think we want to be really careful before we just say, that was that guy. I'm just worried about fill in the blank. Greed is sneaky. That's why Jesus said, don't only take heed, beware. It lurks in your desires and it wants to walk around in your life. Don't be possessed by the pursuit of possessions. So then Jesus illustrates what's truly valuable in 16 through 21. He gives this fictitious story, but it's all too relatable to how they thought then, and frankly, how we still think now that we're separated by thousands of years, an entirely different cultural outlook or ideology. Why is it so relatable? Because it's what we do as human beings. Humanity, apart from God, chases the furtherance of their linear existence with all their might because it's all we think we have. How many people you know that describes them right now? People in your family, people in the workplace, maybe somebody even in your own household. This is what their lives are all about because, frankly, YOLO, right? You're only going through once. Jesus' parable here is timeless to us. This story to convey a heavenly message is to be heard for you and I. So how does it start there in verse number 16? Well, look there again if you would. Jesus gives this parable. The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. Verse 16 shows us in this parable that this fictitious character has a good problem. Boop, boop, right? Oh, that we all had such problems, right? He has this good problem in his mind. He's a wealthy landowner. His farm and land has produced well more than he expected in crops, and therefore that will be utilized to be sold in markets. And he can utilize that either money to buy more possessions, more land, more. He's got a problem. He's got too much money and doesn't know quite what to do with it all. Isn't that the case? He's got money, so it's easier to make money. His crop comes in, and now what's he going to do? In verse 17, it shows us it's so far beyond his expectation. He's trying to figure out how does he manage or leverage this product. And so in verse 18, his solution is not too foreign to us, actually, in today's time. Verse 18, what's his idea? He's sitting there in verse 17 saying, well, what am I going to do? I don't have room to take care of all this. I can't sell it yet. Maybe I need to hang on to it. How am I going to hang on to it? So he's thinking, he's stewing in verse 18. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to pull down my barns. I'm going to get bigger barns. That way, I can store this huge crop. But I also have enough room for all my other goodies, so I'll have this one-stop protected area. All my wealth will be centralized. I'll be in good shape. So his solution is what? To do something that you and I do regularly in our culture. Let me expand my investment portfolio. Isn't that what he's saying? Maybe he is like you or I today. How can I expand this into another business? How can I start or buy another business? I got this money. I need to do something with it. How can I buy another rental property? How can I pay down my house and then take a loan against it towards something else? How can I add to my stock portfolio? He's got a good problem that we often wish we had because we struggle with greed. I want to say it before we move too much further. You don't have to be rich to struggle with greed. You can be poor as Job's turkey in your mind and still struggle with greed because it's not based on how much you have. It's based on your desire and craving to always have what?
More.
Just a little bit more. So this man is looking at his solution and he's thinking, here's what I'll do. I'll expand my portfolio. In verse 19, his motives revealed. Why does he want the bigger barns? Why does he want it to be filled? Why does he want to capitalize on this moment? Because in his mind, he has this idea. And the idea is independence. Independence. What does he want in verse 19? I'll say to myself, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine what? Ease. What's he want to do? Have years of income, years of revenue because of his bumper crop that he's had. He's longing for self-led living, ease, independence, no concerns, no worries, no reliance, no planning, understand it, no anything that he doesn't want to have to do. He's just free to go forward, trapped in greed. I want you to catch it. It's nothing overtly disgusting or perverted or wicked by most people's standards. Right? In verse 19, he doesn't say, I've got all this money, and then I can start, and he would say something abhorrent. I can start a human trafficking ring. All of us would read 19 and be like, oh my goodness. That is disgusting and wicked. Shame on him, and Jesus is right to drop the hammer. He actually says something not as overt and disgusting and horrible as that. But in God's economy, catch it, he still shows it to be what? Awful. Awful to our soul, awful to others, and awful to his purposes. He desires and craves independence from God. If you ask the average person in America, maybe even internationally, I don't know, I don't live there, what their future plans are, what does it typically include in America? We're working, we're saving, we're investing so we can retire. And everybody has this idea of what retirement's going to be like. I don't know that how many of you have captured it, right? In Florida, we had the opportunity to be at a church that was 80% over 65. And they always told me, I have no idea how I ever worked because I go to the doctor all the time. And all the money I thought I'd save, I give to the doctor now. So I'm not sure what I've accomplished. I don't know if you can commiserate in the room. I'm not sure about that. Here's my point. There's this idea, even in our minds as followers of Jesus, sitting in this room saying, yes, I believe Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. I believe other people need to hear of him as the only way of their salvation. I believe it, Paul. Great. But maybe lurking in my mind and in your mind is the hope of getting to a point where we don't have to worry about anyone or anything else. I can retire. So I can go hang out with the grandkids and watch their sporting events. I can play golf as many times as I want and not worry about it. I can eat the Cracker Barrel and enjoy some pancakes, not worry about it. I can travel and not worry about it. And in our mind, initially we say, is that so wrong? And we say back to ourselves, well, no, it's not that bad. But let's have God help us. Because it's an issue of misplaced confidence and sinful motivations. This man in the parable, his confidence is in his wealth and his ability to use the wealth for purposes that he holds alone for years to come. Or so he thought. In the parable, who intervenes and pushes back against his grand scheme, his grand plan? God does. What happens in verse number 20, according to Jesus, in this idea, this fictitious story to help get the point across? God says to him, as he's in the middle of this grand scheme of independence and he can do what he will because he's greedy, what does God call him? Hey, you're just kind of just a little misguided. Let me just help you out there, friend. Hey, you know, I mean, it just you're so close, but just a little off track here. It's not the language used, is it? He calls him a fool. Strong language. In the Bible, in the Old Testament, New Testament, when you see fool attributed to somebody, it is significant, it is difficult, and it is stark, and it's indicative of what's going to go on in their life with mankind and with God. The idea of fool is what? Someone who has access to what God has said, and they can volitionally act upon it, but instead they do what? Reject it. God says this man, scheming up all this plan of independence, stuff that's not too far away from what we think is natural or should be owed us because of all our labors. God says, you fool. He had this false belief. I've got years to come. But he doesn't know how long his life will last, does he? And neither do you, neither do I. God says the end of his life was going to be that very night. He'll have no time to amend his ways. I don't want to sound morbid, but none of us know that you're going to walk out the room tonight. I know I say it a lot, and it may sound annoying. You're likely to die in an auto wreck here in this country more than almost anything else. You don't even know that you'll make it to the Cracker Barrel for lunch today. I'm not trying to be silly. I'm not trying to be cute. I'm not trying to be trite. I'm not trying to be morbid even, like we just bite our nails in anxiety and fear. There's a reality that you as a finite being, me as a finite being, we have very, very, very little control over the next day, much less years to come. And God's not anti-planning and stewardship, of course. But again, it comes back to the misplaced confidence that we think and we know, and for us, for what we want, God says that is foolish. God also condemns his other false belief. For years to come, I'll live in ease. I'll do what I want in all those years. He condemns the idea that you control your own fate. Is it true that God has given you full volition? Yes. You're accountable. You're autonomous. You can make your choices. But whatever you pursue, you're still accountable for. Whatever you do, God in heaven is accounted and knows of it all because nothing's hidden from him, motivationally or through choice and action. God says, this man's a fool. So how's Jesus tidy it all up for us? Well, verse 21, what does he say? So is. Did you hear the story? Everybody maybe in the circle says, we heard you, Jesus. He said, all right, here's what it means. Examine your heart today. Examine your thoughts today. Examine your choices today. What does he say? So is everyone that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. Jesus gives the lesson to the man asking and to all who will hear from that time until today. Don't be like the guy in the parable. He was laying up treasures. The idea is storing, putting aside, trying to safeguard and keep for a particular idea. And he says, don't lay it up on earth. He's not against planning. He's not against stewardship. It's being possessed and pursuing that. It's putting your value there. It's putting your confidence there. It's looking at those things only through the lens of what you want to do, how you want to do it, when you want to do it, rather than be submitted to God. He says, so is everyone, a fool who's rich on this earth, but impoverished with God. It begs the question, I think we all get, how can I be rich on this earth? Most of you would probably say what? Well, tell me your balance in your bank account. Tell me how much is your house worth. Tell me your investment portfolio. Tell me your overall net worth. I don't think it's hard for most of us here to recognize this morning, how can I be rich in this world? You probably can figure it out yourself. Maybe you have a hobby, cars, guns, pottery. I don't even know. Is that a thing? Whatever, right? You're like, this is worth this much. It's that rare. These shoes, this baseball card, it's this much. Whoa, value. But if I flipped it and said, all right, you laid out how you know you can be rich in this world. Now, quick, give me the same four categories, the same five ways that you can be rich towards God.
I said, go to church, right?
I mean, probably should give something. That feels right, probably. That's probably a right answer.
Ask yourself the question.
If you know how to be rich on earth, do you as a professing follower of Christ know how to be rich towards God? If we were trying to just be simple about it, I think we could probably say it this way. What does God value?
People.
Who will spend eternity somewhere forever? People. What does God delight in? His purposes for?
Has let me down here.
His purpose is for people. There we go, right? Yeah. How am I going to be rich towards God?
We know it's when we pursue his nature, his character, his work in and through our life, And that will intersect us with him and those around us and those within our sphere of influence, in our spousal relationship, in our dating relationship, in our kid and have grandkids, nieces and nephew relationships, in our work environments, in our neighborhood, on we could go. So if I want to be rich towards God, here's just a simple way to understand it from the Bible. Know the Lord, follow the Lord, submit to the Lord, and then come into interaction with those he's put around us for his purposes for those people. That's how you can guarantee you'll be rich for God. What does he say in his word? Calls of obedience, calls of decisions, calls of eternal thinking. Submit, yield, say no to greed, and yes to being rich towards God. Friends, it's entirely possible to be greedy and think you're not. Coveting may possibly lead to you getting rich on earth, but it will certainly lead to being eternally poor with God. God loves people. He expects us to invest in his desire for people. One of the ugly things about greed is the pitiful condition it leaves us in and we're prone to without thinking we might be guilty of it. If you've ever unfortunately had someone around your sphere of influence that's maybe been involved in some kind of addictive behavior, gambling, substance abuse, on and on we could go, any kind of addictive behavior, pornography, sexual sin and immorality, whatever it is. And we watch them and we grieve for them and we want them not to be engaged and involved with it because of how it's hurting them. They're sure it'll bring them satisfaction. It does bring what seems like a temporary euphoria for them. And then, gotta get more, just one more. And sometimes I think we stand back and we look at people like that and we look down on them and we think, wow, that's so sad. And we have pity. I would submit to you that the trap of greed is affecting far more people, making them just as pitiful, if not more, while not thinking they have any issue at all. It's more. So it begs the question of us today, who are we actually rich towards? Ourselves and this realm and greed, or towards God, towards his realm, towards his economy, through his desire for people. The day comes, according to Ecclesiastes, that it's not going to matter what title you held and what your net worth got to. Because when you die, guess what? It's going to someone else. And then they're going to use it in a way you can't control. That's real encouraging, isn't it? That's what it is to put your confidence in this realm and greed. It's all subject to fickleness. Fickleness of human nature, the difficulty of time and decay and instability. We have seen this how many times and we don't learn the lesson. Some of you were alive to remember the crash of 2008 in the housing market. Some of you weren't alive, and I don't want to talk to you because that makes me even older. In 2008, I lived in Phoenix, Arizona, then in California, and I watched people's house values halve in less than 30 days. I had somebody that it was in my sphere of influence that had a $1 million home that was worth about $475 in 30 days. My neighbor across the street, when I bought my house for $125,000 in California, paid $400,000 2 years before. That fast, right? I get that's catastrophic. But nothing is guaranteed in this life at all. Banks, governments, possessions, real estate. Again, I'm not saying don't be a good steward. I'm not saying don't be entrepreneur. I'm not saying don't be wealthy. I'm not saying you can't do any of that. But does that have you, or does your passion for God and passion for people have the biggest control of your life, your time, his money he's given you, the house he's given you to use for hospitality to unbelievers and believers alike, the cars, on and on and on we could go. There's an appropriate amount of detachment a Christian should have. I'm not talking about asceticism. I'm talking about detachment. We should value people over things. Today, Is there an area of greed that needs to be excised out because it's idolatry in your thoughts and in your behavior, in your patterns, your spending patterns, your time usage?
I'll leave us with the words of the psalmist in Psalm 119:14. He says this, "I've rejoiced in the way of your testimonies, O God, as much as in all riches." He said, you know what's so valuable to me? Knowing you, knowing what you want, know what you have for my life, knowing what that means for other people. And that is greater than all the riches I could ever have obtained on this earth. So my friends, is covetousness tied to discontentment, finding fault with God's care, finding fault with what he has or hasn't provided, seeing what you deserve and how he has not given it to you or what you're owed, believing you won't have value or that it's diminished or threatened if you don't get, don't have, can't have. My friend, all that's just driven by comparison, self-importance, ego. Jesus is warning us about that this morning because coveting leaves you poor with God forever. I'm calling you today, if you're a follower of Jesus, to ask the Spirit of God during our time of reflection, where am I pursuing things in a greedy way? Maybe today I didn't think of it as greed before, but your Spirit today is saying, well, that is, how are we going to handle that today? You might be here today and you're saying, I'm hearing all that you're saying, but it just doesn't really click or make sense to me. I'm not really seeing it as that valuable. I'm not really seeing it as, it feels weird. I'm going to submit to you that the reason it feels weird is maybe because you don't know what it is to be in God's economy. You don't know what it is to have a relationship with him. You don't know what it is to be freed from greed. And I'm going to encourage you today, like we talked about at the beginning of the service, to start that journey with Jesus by talking to somebody. In a moment, I'm going to pray. When I pray, I'm going to invite you to go out to the foyer where you came in at. There are men and women ready to help you set up a time to talk. If you want to talk today, they're glad to. They just want to help you in understanding the questions you have about Jesus, who he is, and what he's done on your behalf. Is it a little awkward? Sure. I was 15 when I made that decision to have that conversation with one of the people in the church I was going to. Was it awkward? Yeah. Was I a little nervous? Yeah. Did it feel like, what does this mean? What's it going to be? Are they going to hound me? I can just tell you today, personally, take that step of boldness over the awkward step and go out. It'll be for your betterment. Doesn't matter if you're old, think you're set in your ways, young, you're still searching. Whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, today, salvation for you is waiting.